Simon Garfield is a writer with interesting interests, and often it turns out that other people are interested in what interests him. Mauve, How One Man Invented a Colour That Changed the World, was a bestseller. So was Just My Type, about fonts, and On the Map, about how drawing where we are and where everyone else is has kept changing history and continues to do so with GPS. His study of AIDS in Britain, The End of Innocence, won the Somerset Maugham Prize. And his new book is Dog's Best Friend, A Brief History of an Unbreakable Bond. Hello, Simon.
Hello, Jim. Nice to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you. You own a Labrador named Ludo, or at least you did when you started the book, although he was getting on a bit.
Yeah, no, he's still around. I'm in my office talking to you on the second floor of our house, and he unfortunately doesn't really make it up as often as he used to, so his back legs are going a bit, poor thing. No, he used to come up here and sit under my feet, like I say in the book, in the shape of a croissant. And he doesn't do that anymore. He just about makes it up to the first floor to sleep, and that's it. But he's going great. He's 14 and almost 14, an elderly gent.
Ludo, some of us remember from our school days, Latin means I play, of course, and I imagine that's what was behind his naming, a man as erudite as your good self.
No, actually not. What happened was, well, in a way, yes, I think. It was inevitably, dog comes home. It's sort of a decision, family decision, but obviously the kids have the final say in that. Do you choose a genuine name? Do you choose an old-fashioned name? Do you choose an ironic name? You know, So Ludo came about, I think, just because they liked playing Ludo the game. So they weren't thinking of Latin. They were thinking purely of the game, which obviously is called after I Play, as you say. I wanted Cluedo. I thought that would have been a smarter one, a more original one. I don't know of any other dogs named Cluedo, but I was overruled. So probably just as well, because the idea of calling Cluedo in the park is maybe not so great.
You look at the names for dogs quite a bit in this book, and through the ages, Simon, they have usually been short.
Yeah, they've been short and they've had meaning. Obviously, we know about, you know, Fido and Rex and all of those. But in the earliest names that I can find go back to ancient Greece, Xiphon and Phonax and Phlegon and Psyche and all of these. And they basically meant something, and they actually described what they did. So they would be guard or courage or spirit or those kind of things. And now what we do inevitably is call, I suppose I say inevitably because, you know, dogs are now so much more part of our family than they were, you know, in ancient times. And we call them after our kids, basically, all the same sort of names that we would call our kids. So the most popular names in the UK, and this is from sort of, you know, registered insured dogs, are Max and Bella. And then it's things like Charlie and Jim and all those things. So we absolutely could be calling our kids as well as our dogs. I've got a long list of the Queen's Corgis names as well, which are sort of quite bizarre and maybe not what you'd expect. So, you know, there were some sort of complicated pedigree names like Roosevelt Lucky Strike and Lee's Maldwin Lancelot. But then there's also Mask and Brush and Sweep and Dipper and Smokey, and, you know, it's kind of odd things.
There's a charming photo in your book of the young Princess Elizabeth with a corgi named Jane in her arms. And that's a really good point about the Queen's Corgis. Most of us wouldn't have a clue what they've been named over the years. That's interesting. Some of the, before I get into the way that dogs have been sucked into our families now, as you have been referring to, some of the names, I've just got to say, of those Crufts dog show champions in your book just seem ludicrous. I Believe in Angels, Oasis of Peace. Now, I know that's a pedigree sort of name, but that doesn't fully explain how dogs have ended up with these monikers.
No, I think you would explain that just in terms of general human insanity, really. I mean, I suppose if you're showing a dog at Crufts, you want a name that not necessarily people are going to remember, but that people are going to say, what was that? Who is this dog? So, you know, you definitely wouldn't call him Rex, I don't think.
You wanted to know how humans have gone from being fond of dogs but treating them in a more utilitarian sort of way to pampering them beyond belief sometimes, and certainly, as you say, making them part of the family thoroughly. Why have we?
Well, you're right. So the sort of quest of the book, I suppose, was to say, are we losing the essential nature of dogs insofar as are we mollycoddling them too much? Are we making them too human? Are we trying to please ourselves too much and forgetting what they really want? And I wanted to see where that balance sort of lay, who was top dog, because our relationship began about 15,000 years ago as a fairly mutual one. We would leave food lying around our dwelling place, and the dog wolf, you know, because we know that dogs descended from grey wolves, would say, hang on a minute, this is handy, I don't have to actually hunt, you know, for myself all the time, because all these humans are leaving food around. And we also then realized, actually, it would be quite nice to, you know, train dogs, because they will help us with hunting, and they will provide warmth and a certain amount of comfort as well. And so, you know, it was a mutual thing. The book begins with me taking my dog to the cinema, because one can now. And I kind of thought, okay, well, this is an interesting exercise. So there's a cinema in South London, which pre-COVID used to screen films for owners and their dogs. And you had to turn up with a dog to get in. And they would initially be dog-related films like Lady and the Tramp or Isle of Dogs. And then they became sort of any old film, really. And they used to keep the lights a little higher so the dogs wouldn't get frightened, and the dogs got treats. And this was, I thought, well, this is an interesting development. Well, what does the dog get out of this? Not awfully much. And then there was a dog cafe that opened quite near us as well. And I thought, okay, is this just, you know, essentially like a, you know, like a bar or something where they're, you know, dogs are welcome, or a restaurant? But actually, no. So the dog menu is much longer than the human menu. And now also what we understand about the science of dogs, you know, with genetics, and there's a far kind of clearer idea of what genes were bred out from the wolf and what we've kept and what the dog has decided to keep in a way. So there was a research which came out quite recently about how dogs have a muscle in their eyebrow that wolves don't have, which is one that essentially makes them look cute and a bit helpless and a bit inquisitive and a bit like a baby, like a human baby. So the idea there is that they encourage more love and more treats. And so we're finding out way more now about dogs than we ever knew. What we knew, of course, was what great companions they were. You know, no one had to have any science to tell us that.
How did evolution do that with the muscle and the eyebrow? That's pretty amazing.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's they're looking at that now. But it's funny, because we think, okay, so we domesticated dogs, but in a way they domesticated themselves as well.
But your essential thesis, I think, is that it's the dogness of dogs, you may even use that phrase, that brings out the best in humans, not the sort of ersatz humanness of dogs.
Yeah, I think it's a mutual thing. We have used dogs in ways that we could never have imagined, and trained dogs in ways that we could never have imagined even, you know, 100 years ago. You know, we know about how dogs are used to help diabetics, hopefully avoiding hypos. We know about bomb detection, you know, all these different things. And one of the things that I enjoy doing most is going with a border terrier called Bryn around our local hospital. You now have therapy dogs in almost all quarters of life. So, you know, to ease pressures on exams, you would have a dog in a classroom. So very good at picking up our emotions. But going around the hospital with Bryn was an extraordinary thing. So this was Bryn's a border collie who you think maybe isn't the, you know, most docile animal in the world. But actually, he went around this oncology unit and a lot of people were having chemo drugs. And it was a highlight of their week. You know, they said so many people saying how they look forward to seeing this dog and how much comfort they derived from him and how much easier it was to go through what is obviously a very harrowing experience. So this kind of, you know, we're always finding more uses. And I think dogs love having a duty. I don't really talk about dog hunting because I know, having been on a hunt, that you know how dogs are, how the hounds are kind of cooped up for so long, and then when they become too old to hunt, they basically then can't live with anyone because they've only known one life and they get put down. And I didn't really want to, you know, dwell on those kind of things, but there was one thing which I did find extraordinary. I'm not sure whether this is classed as cruelty or love, but during the beginning of the Second World War, Brits, as you know, we pride ourselves on our dog madness and how we love dogs. I'm sure New Zealand owners are, you know, exactly the same. But we killed something like 400,000 domestic pets in the first few weeks of World War II.
I couldn't believe that.
No, I couldn't believe that. I mean, I knew something had happened and I'd heard that, but I mean, there's no doubt now that this was the case. There are pictures of awful pictures, really, of dogs piled up outside animal kind of rescue shelters and vets who have been euthanized. And the idea was, and this was partly a government suggestion. It wasn't a demand. It wasn't a legal thing, but it was a suggestion that maybe, you know, dogs aren't going to be the most important thing at the beginning of the war anymore. We're not going to maybe have enough food. Another historian calls it a Holocaust of pets. And we couldn't bear to see them either go hungry or, you know, suffer in other ways during the war.
But we didn't leave it very long. I mean, 400,000 dogs and cats killed in the first 4 days. We didn't even give them a chance and see how the food stretched out. And
no. I mean, I think you're right. But I mean, I think the reason for that is because we sort of knew war was coming for a year.
Dog's Best Friend, A Brief History of an Unbreakable Bond, and Simon Garfield is talking to us. Well, you've covered a bit of territory. A companion dog, you know, and a therapy dog, a great idea that you've mentioned, but that can cost $17,000 here, which is more than £8,000, you know, where you are. And you spend a few pages on therapy dogs, and you make the point that people had them in Charles Dickens's day, you know, pre-Labradoodle and so on. So perhaps an ordinary breed will do. I mean, you mention the Border Collie, actually, and no one would have thought a Border Collie was suitable, but perhaps all sorts of dogs would be fine for therapy.
Oh, yeah, it's a question of training. There's absolutely no proof. In fact, you could argue the opposite, that you need any sort of pedigree dog at all. I mean, we know from experience that Labradors make very, very good family pets, and they make very good sort of seeing eye dogs as well. But absolutely, I mean, any dog can be trained up.
You've got some pretty firm opinions about crossbreeding, and you say the poodle and the Labrador are both prone to hip problems, and crossbreeding can exacerbate that. The Labradoodle was meant to be a low allergen seeing eye dog, you say, originally.
Yeah, so for a woman in Hawaii who couldn't see, and her partner was allergic to dogs. So he thought, well, what can I do here? And the Labradoodle was born. I mean, that's a kind of simplified, you know, shortened version of the tale. The Hawaiian woman and her partner were fantastically happy. And it took a while for these things to catch on. People thought, no, actually, this isn't a kind of great thing. But then, and also they didn't look so great. But after a while, these things became really useful things. And then people wanted them because they began to look more and more beautiful, and they were bred not for their utility, but for kind of other reasons. They were very cuddly, attractive dogs. And then after that, the feeling was you could cross anything with anything and have a cuter dog or a rarer dog, or, you know, a dog, as I said, that looked better on social media. And that's the real, you know, the real problem now, I think, as well, is that in a way we've always lived with dogs that are useful to us. We've always made that choice. But I think now the sort of extremes of breeding are definitely not for the benefit of the dog.
I was interested in the Australian bloke who perfected the Labradoodle but made no money out of it, and he was told a reporter he had made a number of subsequent charlatans rich. Not to disrespect any Labradoodle breeders today, that was a long time ago, but he was very down on the idea, wasn't he?
Yeah, no, he sort of thinks he created a monster, really. You know, he was a very careful breeder and took a huge amount of time, but people thought, hey, this is easy. We get a lab and we get a poodle and we put them in a, you know, in a garden together or whatever. If you have enough money, there are labs in South Korea and in Texas, and I imagine a lot of other places now as well, that will accept some cells from a recently passed dog, a dog that's died. You put the dog in the freezer for a bit. You take a little bit of its skin, you send it in, and they will make a clone of your dog. Now, it's not going to be an identical copy, but it will be, you know, it will have a similar genetic makeup. And so that's an extraordinary thing. That's something that I think obviously we've taken too far. And I think that's, you know, popularized, I think, initially by, you know, Hollywood stars with more money than sense, but it is becoming a cheaper and more popular thing.
We anthropomorphize dogs out of sight now, don't we, in all the ways you've been alluding to. And you make the point in this book that when a dog steals food after being told not to and we see a guilty look, it's not actually a guilty look.
Yeah, it's a bizarre thing, really. It's I mean, this goes back to Darwin, again, another Victorian link. You know, nothing is kind of brand new. So he detected two things. He detected guilt. He also detected something called the hothouse face, where basically he would. One of he loved dogs. Had all sorts of dogs. One dog, he would put on his boots, and the dog would think, "Great, I'm going for a walk now with Charles Darwin," and Charles Darwin would then veer off into his greenhouse to look at seedlings or whatever, and the dog would be so disappointed because it wasn't going to get a walk. So the dog had this sort of really disappointed, pathetic sort of face that he called a hothouse face. And he wrote about this a lot, this rather sort of pathetic, kind of disappointed look. But now we have a look that dogs put on, we think, because it's what they think we expect of them. So a dog will be left with some food and they will either take it or not, and the owner will then come into the room and sort of reprimand the dog for taking the food, even if they haven't. And the dog would look guilty because they thought somehow that was what the owner, you know, wanted them. So it's a sort of wanted them to look. It's a kind of inbuilt thing now, and as I said, it goes back to that muscle eyebrow thing. It's something that dogs learn very fast about what gives them love, what gives them food, you know, all those essential things. I mean, they're pretty basic demands, but they're very smart, and they're often smarter than we give them credit for, I think.
Will we keep having the time for dogs? Because in your book, Timekeepers, you say, you know, we pay for speedy boarding so we can sit on a plane and wait for everyone else to board. And when we land, we pay to get fast-tracked. And we used to have time to think, but now communication barely gives us that. And dogs need time, don't they? I mean, they don't need to be left at home while we work all day. They do need to be walked. They do need to be talked to, Simon.
Yes, I think that's one thing that, you know, people who've got puppies for the first time realize now, if they didn't realize when they brought a dog home, is exactly that. You know, it's time beyond just, you know, the hour in the park or half hour in the park. It's being with your dog as a companion. That's not to say you've got to give him or her total attention all the time, or play with them all the time, because they'd get exhausted and probably bored with that as well. But you sort of absolutely, you know, they do become part of the family, and they are a family member, and you have to treat them as such. And you have to think about, you know, I mean, you talk about time, you have to think about the time ahead. So, you know, a dog will hopefully live 13, 14, 15 years. So you think, okay, so what does that mean about my plans to have regular vacations, or you know, working away from home, or all those things? So I think all those things have to be you know, factored in. But, you know, as I said, not to the point where your dog takes over your life. I think, again, I mean, that balance is kind of interesting. You know, trainers will say, well, you've still got to let a dog sort of do what it wants, be a little bit independent, you know, not make sure you're in the same room with the dog all the time, because I don't think that kind of helps them either. But then the vets and the, you know, the healthcare and the insurance and all those kind of things as well. So, yes, it affects your life in all ways, is all I can say.
And then the vets, yes, it's a very ominous phrase. So, yeah, I'd love to know which movies dogs like. That was fascinating revelation. You've got the top dogs in art in there. You mentioned how music can calm dogs, a Spotify list, you know, for Spot. Not a bad idea. I noticed the song Shannon by Henry Gross isn't in your book anywhere, Simon. Do you have a favorite song about dogs?
Oh, God, I think me and you and a dog named Boo, I think. Ludo likes most things, really, most things that we play him, apart from the Hoover. He doesn't like the vacuum cleaner very much in terms of sound. But everything else, as long as it's not too loud, then he's pretty happy.
Last question. I mean, a lot of dogs to choose from in literature. Your book's so full of stuff, I have no possible way of getting to it all, but a lot of dogs to choose from in literature, like Snoopy or like Karenin in The Unbearable Lightness of Being. So why is Bullseye in Oliver Twist the most memorable of all dogs in literature?
Well, having said, I didn't really want to dwell on, you know, the downside of dogs and the cruelty. I think as a reader, one is so shocked by how badly Bullseye is treated by his master, Sykes. And it's such a vivid image in the film as well, which I think is probably what I remember even, you know, even more than the book, the classic films, I think two or three of them. And I think the ending as well, where basically Sykes dies and Bullseye essentially hurls himself out of the window, because the idea of a normal life or life without his owner still comes through. I mean, the one thing we haven't really had time to talk about is, you know, the incredible stories of loyalty.
Yes.
Both in reality and myths and in dog literature as well. The one thing that we, and I think Dickens absolutely got this right, is that the one thing that we really always repeat in literature and art is fidelity, how faithful dogs are to us and how important that idea is for us, that unconditional love. And there's the classic case of, there was a film obviously this as well, of, you know, an Edinburgh Greyfriars Barbie just refusing to leave his owner's grave.
I'm glad you emphasised the loyalty and the unconditional love, but you do say of Greyfriars, or do imply of Greyfriars Bobby in Edinburgh with that statue that probably a lot of people will have been to, and the dog who sat beside his master's grave for 14 years. You do suspect a bit of marketing might have gone on, shall we say, with Greyfriars Bobby, not to spoil a good story.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I mean, you know, sort of, no one knows the value of a dog better than an advertiser and a marketer in terms of, you know, so many adverts now with talking dogs and, you know, all that kind of stuff. So I think it probably benefited the local community and the local pub there to have that, you know, to have that image. There may have been several Barbies there, and you know, they were quite scruffy dogs. They maybe looked like one another. Maybe a few dogs were hanging around the grave. So I think we love a dog myth. You know, this goes back to that idea that we want dogs to love us as much as we love dogs. It's quite hard to get away, you know, on a holiday because of our dog, and it's costing so much, and oh no, he sort of, you know, he scratched himself again, and we've got to go to the vet again, and, you know, all those kind of things. And you forget about that instantly, you know, as soon as they become elderly and unwell, you sort of forgive them everything. And I think that's sort of part of the, you know, of the myth making as well. It's like our kids, you get cross with them if they've scribbled on the wall, but, you know, ultimately a day later you forgive them.
Seeing as we're ending on that emotional note, I am going to play Shannon rather than me and you and a dog named Boo. Hey, lovely to talk to you. Dog's Best Friend, A Brief History of an Unbreakable Bond, and Simon Garfield has been kind enough to talk to us. Many thanks, Simon.
Great talking to you, Jim.